You know, it's funny how we tend to think of our technology as, well, ours. Like you buy a high-end gaming PC or a new console, you set it up on your desk, and it just feels like this independent, self-contained little universe that belongs entirely to you.
Right, yeah, it's sitting right there in your room. It feels very local.
Exactly. But welcome to the deep dive. Today we are looking at a stack of incredibly revealing stories from the August 25, 2026 edition of the Tekken Night Tech and Gaming Digest. And our mission for this deep dive is to basically look behind the curtain of that little universe on your desk.
Because the reality is, your local machine is really just a like a tiny node on a massive invisible spider web.
Yeah, and when the giant spider at the center of that web twitches, your entire setup shakes. We're going to explore this massive collision between mind-bending centralized digital infrastructure, so things like hyperscale AI data centers and global mega games, and your actual day-to-day consumer experience.
I mean, the divide between localized personal tech and hyper-centralized enterprise infrastructure has completely collapsed at this point. The overarching theme of all these sources today is causality. Like what happens in a corporate server rack today dictates exactly what you can play, how you play it, and what you are forced to pay for the privilege tomorrow.
Right, and let's start unpacking that causality at the absolute foundation, which is the silicon itself. The Tekken Night Digest highlights a reveal from Hot Chips 2026 that is frankly just breaking people's brains. IBM unveiled a new enterprise processor.
Oh, this chip is wild.
It really is. We are talking about a 2-nanometer gate-all-around process. It's an 11-core beast hitting base frequencies of like 5.7 gigahertz. But before we even get into what makes it unique architecturally, let's just break down the sheer physics of this. 2 nanometers, I mean, that is practically the width of a few atoms, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
And what does gate all around actually mean when we're dealing with something that microscopic?
Well, think of a transistor as like a microscopic water valve controlling the flow of electricity. As we shrink these chips down to that 2-nanometer scale, the channels carrying that electrical current get so unimaginably small that the power just starts leaking out.
Wow, like it just spills over.
Literally, yeah. It's
Oh,
quantum tunneling. The electricity just bleeds right through the walls. So, gate all around, or GAA, solves this by wrapping the control gate around the electrical channels on all four sides. It completely envelops the wire to prevent that power leakage.
okay, so they are essentially putting a highly pressurized seal on the electrical flow.
Exactly.
And the source also mentions they're using low dielectric materials to hit that 5.7 gigahertz speed without the whole thing just melting. I assume that's another form of leak prevention.
It acts like high-tech insulation, really. When you have billions of incredibly tiny wires packed that closely together and you push signals through them at 5.7 billion cycles per second.
Which is just an insane number to even say out loud.
Right. But they create massive electrical interference with one another at those speeds. So the low-grade dielectric material sits between those wires and it reduces the capacitance. It allows the chip to sustain those massive frequencies without generating catastrophic heat.
Wow.
I mean, sustaining 5.7 gigahertz on a 2-nanometer process is a monumental achievement in thermal dissipation.
Okay, so the physics are mind-blowing, but here is where the architecture gets really interesting to me. This chip has the unique ability to switch in literal nanoseconds between legacy banking instructions, what IBM calls architecture, and the modern ARM64 ecosystem.
Yeah, the dual architecture setup is huge.
It's essentially like having a bilingual genius who can instantly translate ancient battle-tested banking ledgers into modern Python AI scripts in real time, completely without skipping a beat.
That's a great way to put it.
But here is my pushback on this, right? If this 2-nanometer chip is so unfathomably fast and capable in the modern ARM ecosystem, why bother dragging along all that legacy banking code at all? Why not just force the global banks to rewrite everything for the modern era?
Honestly,
Yeah.
the answer just comes down to risk. IBM's chief product officer, Tina Tarquinio, addressed this directly in the source, stating that, and this is a quote, "Mainframe computing is not legacy technology." Yeah, because the older software running on these mainframes manages the core ledgers of global finance. Every single credit card swipe, every mortgage transfer, stock trades, it has been battle-tested for decades to achieve eight nines of reliability.
Wait, 8 nines? I mean, I've heard of 5 nines for standard server uptime, which is like, what, 5 minutes of downtime a year? But 8 nines seems mathematically impossible.
It translates to less than 0.3 seconds of downtime per year.
Oh my God.
right? So if you force banks to rewrite that foundational code into a modern language, you introduce the risk of catastrophic bugs.
Yeah.
A single routing error in a newly rewritten, untested banking system could cost billions of dollars and just destabilize entire financial markets overnight.
Okay, yeah, nobody wants that.
Exactly. So by preserving the legacy architecture on the exact same silicon as the modern ARM cores, and they have this new Spire AI accelerator on there too, banks get the best of both worlds.
So they can run real-time AI fraud scoring using modern PyTorch frameworks directly against the core financial ledgers.
Yes, with zero network latency. There's no sending data to a separate server and waiting for a response. It is instant, flawless execution on identical silicon.
That is fascinating. So if you are listening right now and wondering why you as a consumer should care about a banking chip, well, this enterprise obsession with AI chips like that Spire AI accelerator is having a direct painful consequence for your wallet at home.
Oh, absolutely. It's hitting consumers hard.
The Digest cites an analytical report from PC World describing a K-shaped economic divide in PC hardware right now. Basically, enterprise technology is soaring upward while consumer accessibility is trending sharply downward. Hyperscale AI data centers just have this insatiable appetite for high bandwidth memory HBM and enterprise grade DDR5. But how does that actually impact the RAM I want to buy for my gaming PC?
Well, it really comes down to the rigid limitations of global wafer fabrication.
The actual physical factories.
Right. A foundry like TSMC or Samsung only has a fixed capacity for how many silicon wafers they can process per month. High bandwidth memory, which is completely critical for these AI GPUs, involves stacking memory chips vertically.
Like a skyscraper of memory.
Exactly. And it is incredibly complex and requires immense fab capacity. So the foundries are looking at the market and seeing that enterprise AI silicon yields massive, massive profit margins compared to standard consumer RAM.
So the high-margin enterprise AI chips are basically just bullying the consumer components out of the production line.
They are completely dominating the fabrication allocation. The foundries are prioritizing AI server demands, and that creates a severe bottleneck for consumer memory production.
And the direct result of that supply constraint is the 15% price spike in consumer PC RAM and NVMe solid state storage that we're seeing right now, just as we head into the late 2026 upgrade season.
Yeah, Gordon Ma-Ung, the senior hardware editor at PC World, summarized it perfectly. PC gamers are effectively paying the indirect cost of the AI boom.
We are subsidizing the AI revolution every time we buy a stick of RAM.
That's exactly what's happening.
So if you are sitting at home right now, looking at your shopping cart and debating whether to pull the trigger on a new rig, do not panic. The Digest provides a really solid workaround guide so you don't have to just blindly pay the AI tax.
Yeah, there are definitely ways around the worst of it.
First off, drop that 64 gigabyte kit from your cart. Standardize on 32 gigabytes of dual channel memory. That is all you need for modern gaming anyway. Second, dive into your BIOS and enable your XMP 3.0 or XPO profiles.
That is such a crucial step that people miss.
Right. That forces your system to squeeze every drop of bandwidth out of the RAM you already own, rather than just leaving performance on the table. And for storage, the guide says stick to PCIe 4.0 drives. Avoid the massive premiums of PCIe 5.0 because the actual real-world gaming gains are virtually non-existent.
Yeah, following that advice really shields you from the worst of the K-shaped divide. The underlying economic truth remains, however, that individual consumers are entirely at the mercy of hyperscale infrastructure demands.
Which sort of begs the question, if we're paying these massive premiums just to build a capable machine, what kind of software are we getting that actually justifies this hardware?
It has to be something spectacular.
Right, and that brings us to the unprecedented scale of Gamescom 2026. Europe's premier interactive entertainment exposition in Cologne just broke records. The opening night live presentation, hosted by Jeff Cayley, drew over 2.3 million concurrent viewers globally.
Just massive numbers.
They had 1,450 exhibiting companies from 64 different nations, 400 indie devs alone. But technically, what jumped out from the source is the heavy emphasis on neural rendering pipelines.
Ah, yes. Things like Sony's PSSR 2.0 and NVIDIA's DLSS 4.
Exactly. These games are pushing 120 hertz ultrafluidity and a level of photorealism that permanently blurs the line between interactive gameplay and cinematic CGI.
I mean, the visual fidelity on display there is just staggering. But it requires us to completely redefine how we measure performance.
How so?
Well, these neural upscalers operate by rendering the game internally at a much lower base resolution. That saves a tremendous amount of computational power on the GPU. Then, that use AI models running on dedicated tensor cores to predict and generate the high-resolution pixels, and in many cases, entirely new intermediate frames in real time.
Okay, let me challenge that for a second, though. With AI, neural upscalers essentially faking high-resolution frames, are we actually getting better, more responsive games, or just prettier AI-generated illusions?
That's the big debate, isn't it?
Yeah, like if the machine is guessing what the next frame should look like instead of calculating the actual physics and geometry, isn't that inherently less authentic than rendering it natively?
It is a profound philosophical shift in rendering technology, absolutely. You are no longer just rendering geometry, you are inferring it based on temporal feedback and deep learning matrices. But the visual results and the fluidity they provide are undeniable to the human eye.
I mean, they do look incredible.
They do. And Jeff Cayley actually noted during the broadcast that gaming has become the universal creative language of our time. But the profound irony here is the technology itself.
Oh, wait, I see where you're going with this.
Right. The exact same AI infrastructure, the deep learning matrices and tensor cores, that is causing the hardware shortage and driving up the price of your PC memory in the foundries.
Is the exact technology being used on your graphics card to render the photorealistic worlds that make you want to upgrade your PC in the first place?
Exactly. It's a closed loop.
That is wild. AI creates the bottleneck in the supply chain and then sells you the neural rendering solution to get around it. It's brilliant and slightly terrifying.
It really is.
Now, creating virtual worlds that demanding puts an unimaginable amount of pressure on the studios building them. And when a project reaches that level of cultural gravity like Rockstar's upcoming Grand Theft Auto 6, every single byte of data becomes a target.
The target on their backs is massive.
Yeah, the Digest mentions Take-Two Interactive has initiated aggressive federal DMCA subpoenas, targeting platforms like Discord, X, and YouTube to hunt down a leaker known as CyberLeak. They are mobilizing a massive legal apparatus to protect their intellectual property ahead of the game's November launch.
The corporate response is severe, definitely. But
yeah.
Inside the industry, veteran developers view this entirely differently.
Really? Like, they aren't worried.
Well, Avi Vermeijs, the former technical director at Rockstar Games who worked on San Andreas and GTA V, publicly called these gameplay leaks a complete nothing burger.
A nothing burger. That's quite a statement.
Yeah, he contrasted the current panic with the infamous 2004 hot coffee crisis.
Oh, wow. Okay, let's contextualize that for a second for anyone who might not remember. The hot coffee scandal involved hidden sexually explicit mini games within the code of GTA San Andreas that modders managed to unlock.
And the fallout from that was catastrophic for the studio. It resulted in multi-million dollar litigation from the FTC. It forced mandatory physical disc recalls from retail stores worldwide.
Which is just a logistical nightmare.
Oh, completely. And the game was slapped with a commercial adults-only rating, which essentially banned it from major retailers like Walmart and Target. That was a true existential threat to the studio's bottom line.
Wait, pulling physical discs off shelves globally? That is millions of dollars just evaporating overnight.
Right.
So compared to that, Vermeijs is basically saying that some early, unpolished test footage leaking online is just background noise. Especially since CyberLeak didn't expose the proprietary engine source code, just visual spoilers.
Exactly.
I mean, even if the entire script leaked today, millions would still line up on launch day. And the market reflects that, actually. Amidst all of this panic over the leaked footage, Take-Two's stock actually appreciated by 25%.
Yeah, the market didn't flinch.
Does this prove the old adage that no press is bad press, even when it's unauthorized test footage of the most anticipated game of the decade?
I think it demonstrates this concept of brand resilience.
Mm.
When a cultural artifact reaches a certain mass, when it transcends being just a game and becomes a mega game, it generates a gravitational pull that absorbs controversy and converts it directly into engagement.
It just feeds the hype machine.
Exactly. The viral global reaction to those leaks simply reinforced to investors that the consumer demand for GTA 6 is practically bulletproof. The leaks didn't hurt the brand, they validated its dominance.
Bulletproof digital hype. But that digital invincibility stands in incredibly sharp contrast to the grim reality facing physical media collectors right now.
Oh, it's a completely different story for physical media.
While the digital software of these mega games is thriving, the physical media you hold in your hands is actively dying. Let's look at the controversy over the physical release of Call of Duty, Modern Warfare 4 on the Nintendo Switch 2.
Yeah, this one is rough.
After a 13-year hiatus, Call of Duty returns to a Nintendo home console. But the physical retail edition has been confirmed as a code and box.
This is where the physical illusion breaks down completely.
Right, so imagine this. You go to a store, you pay full retail price, you unwrap the plastic, you pop open the case, and there is no 64-gigabyte ROM cartridge inside. The box is completely empty except for a paper slip with a download code on it.
It's so frustrating for collectors.
It's exactly like buying a beautifully bound hardcover book at a bookstore, bringing it home, and when you open it, the pages are totally blank except for a QR code to download a PDF of the novel.
That is a perfect analogy, and the driving force behind this shift is pure, unadulterated economics. The manufacturing premiums for high-capacity solid-state media are just exorbitant right now.
Like, how much more are we talking?
Well, producing a 64-gigabyte Switch 2 NAND flash game card costs more than four times as much as pressing a standard 100-gigabyte PS5 UHD optical Blu-ray disc.
Four times. Wow.
Yeah. Furthermore, modern games have just ballooned in size. Modern Warfare 4 requires a mandatory 120-gigabyte digital payload just to run.
Which the Switch 2 can't hold out of the box.
Right. This forces players to invest in high-speed microSD Express expansion cards on top of the retail price of the game.
But economically, just from a business standpoint, doesn't this make sense? If manufacturing that high-capacity cartridge is four times as expensive, why should Microsoft and Activision eat that massive production cost just to appease a niche market of physical media collectors?
Well, sure, from a quarterly earnings perspective, avoiding that cost is perfectly logical. But from a consumer rights and preservation perspective, it is deeply alarming. Colin Moriarty, who's the host of the Sacred Symbols podcast, called it an affront to physical media.
Yeah.
Consumers are being charged premium retail packaging prices for what is ultimately just a Clive license. This ties directly into what archivists are calling the digital ownership crisis.
Let's expand on that library analogy. It's like buying that beautiful blank hardcover book, but you can only read the PDF while standing inside a specific digital library. You don't actually own the story at all.
Exactly. You own a revocable license to access the game on a centralized server, and the archival vulnerability here is severe. If the Nintendo eShop authentication servers ever shut down in future generations, which, by the way, we have already seen happen with the Wii and the 3DS storefronts.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, that game is completely lost to history. Without a physical ROM cartridge containing the executable code, your plastic box basically just becomes a useless piece of trash.
Which all ties back to that spiderweb metaphor we started with. We are entirely dependent on these central digital systems, and we are uniquely vulnerable when those central systems break.
We really are.
Let's look at our final story from the Tekken Night Digest, the emergency Windows 11 rollback. Following the August 2026 patch Tuesday, Microsoft had to deploy an emergency known issue rollback, or a KEIR. The standard update introduced severe system anomalies across two entirely different, seemingly unrelated pipelines.
And the sheer specificity of the bugs introduced by the single patch is just a testament to how impossibly complex modern operating systems have become.
Right. So the update triggered severe micro stuttering and frame rate drops in DirectX 12 games. And at the exact same time, it caused catastrophic crashing in .NET WPF desktop applications.
Which basically means it broke your ability to print or export PDFs?
Yeah. It ruined your top-tier gaming frame rates at night and stopped you from printing a document at the office during the day. Talk about a bad day for productivity and procrastination.
It's the worst of both worlds.
But how on earth does one patch break a high-end graphics pipeline and a basic office printer?
It comes down to the underlying shared architecture. The patch modified core low-level rendering libraries. Specifically, it destabilized the timing mechanisms used for graphics pipeline scheduling in DirectX 12 while simultaneously corrupting the graphics device interface, or GDI.
And what does the GDI do?
That's the legacy core that draws text and UI elements for older .NET applications. So a single microscopic change at the foundation cascaded upward, breaking two completely disparate user experiences.
But Microsoft fixed it. And the mechanism they used to fix it is the really important part here.
Oh, definitely.
They deployed an automated server-side rollback. They didn't push out a press release asking you to manually download a fix. Their central cloud infrastructure silently reached out to your local machine over the internet and automatically reverted the problematic code to restore stability without you ever lifting a finger.
Which is an incredibly impressive feat of network engineering by Microsoft's Windows and .NET directorate. The system essentially heals itself.
Right.
But it underscores the reality of modern computing. Your local, expensive hardware only functions properly because a centralized cloud server is constantly monitoring and managing it.
So what does this all mean for you sitting at your desk? Let's take a step back and look at the thematic journey we've been on today. We started at the absolute pinnacle of enterprise engineering with IBM's dual architecture 2-nanometer mainframe chip, proving that centralized computing has never been more powerful or more critical. We saw how the hyperscale AI demand for that power is monopolizing wafer fabrication and actively driving up the cost of consumer PC memory. We explored the massive AI-rendered scale of Gamescom and how the cultural gravity of mega games like GTA 6 makes them virtually bulletproof to corporate leaks.
It's all connected.
And finally, we looked at the fragile reality of the consumer experience. Buying empty plastic boxes for Switch games you don't actually own and relying entirely on automated cloud rollbacks just to keep your PC running.
Connecting all these dots leaves us with a profound reality to consider, really. We are accelerating rapidly toward a purely digital, purely licensed ecosystem.
Yeah.
Our physical games are increasingly just access codes and empty boxes. Our localized hardware, no matter how powerful, is utterly dependent on automated cloud infrastructure to function. If that central spider web is holding everything together, what happens when a central authentication server suffers a catastrophic update failure that it can't automatically roll back?
Oh.
If the servers go dark permanently, do our incredibly powerful AI-inflated machines just become temporary expensive paperweights?
That is a terrifying but very necessary question to think about the next time you look at that self-contained little universe sitting on your desk. The spider web is always there, even when you can't see it. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the digital realities of 2026. Keep questioning the systems around you, and we will see you next time.